Hello, podcast listeners. This is Molly Myers, one of the consultants at Amplify Process Safety. The upcoming podcast discusses the documentation needed for pressure relief design, and I wanted to let you know that Amplify can assist you with this documentation and associated design calculations. So if you have any relief valves or rupture discs installed in your process, and you either don't have the necessary design basis documentation, or you aren't sure if the information you have is adequate, contact us for help. You can reach us via email at info@amplifyconsultants.com or send me an email directly at molly.myers@amplifyconsultants.com. That's molly.myers. We'd love to hear from you.
Welcome to Amplify Your Process Safety, the podcast that provides the experience and expertise you need when it comes to process safety and risk management. Our hands-on approach will give you the insight needed, whether you're new to industry or process safety, in a role where you interact with aspects of process safety, or an experienced process safety professional. Join us in our mission to protect people, the companies they work for, and the communities where they operate by making process safety knowledge available to all.
Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Amplify Your Process Safety podcast. I'm Molly Myers, and thanks for joining us in this podcast session. In this episode, I'm excited to be joined by my friend and former colleague, Chris Baskatch. Say hi, Chris.
Hey, everybody.
So Chris is the flare master at the Phillips 66 Wood River Refinery in Roxana, Illinois. Chris and I worked together there for several years managing the relief system design information for the refinery. Chris is a fellow chemical engineer, but he could have been a mechanical engineer based on his love of rebuilding cars. So, Chris, why don't you tell listeners a little bit about yourself and explain what on earth a flare master does?
All right. Well, thanks, Molly. I guess just so everybody knows, I actually got into rebuilding cars. I guess that was something my dad was interested in. And also from a younger age, I've always been interested in racing. So, you know, fortunately, having that knowledge and that you do learn to love rebuilding cars after deciding you want to race them. So
keep them in tip top shape.
Very, okay. Very complimentary interests. So mm-hmm. and now I work somewhere where they make fuel for them. So that's pretty good.
All right.
Yeah.
So what is a flare master?
Yeah. So a flare master, I think they said it's a Conoco term, but in any other industry, I've heard it referred to as a relief systems engineer or pressure safety engineer or something like that. It's kind of a hybrid between a chemical and mechanical engineer, really, that looks at the relief requirements and the overpressure scenarios and, you know, your flare systems and all that. I used to have it referred to as the emergency relief systems. So.
All right. Thanks. Well, thanks for joining us. For today's podcast, we're going to discuss the documentation requirements for pressure relief devices. There are just a few short references to relief devices in the actual text of the PSM standard, but the expectations for the amount of documentation that's required has grown significantly since the PSM standard was promulgated way back in 1992. So today we'll touch on many of those expectations, including the relief system design and design basis information that's required for process safety information, or PSI, the reference information needed to support your PHAs, and the relief device and vent system information needed for your mechanical integrity, or MI, program. So why don't we start off with what are the expectations for the relief system design and design basis that's called for in the PSI section?
So, yeah, like you said, the standard is written in a pretty open way, and they rely on, you know, REG-AGEP is kind of the thing they look for. That'd be the recognized and generally accepted good engineering
practices. Yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, where that is now, you do expect for any relief device, or even where you don't have one, to be honest, you need a good listing of all the potential relief scenarios, and not just the ones that result in relief, also the ones that don't result in a relief, so you can justify to somebody auditing, why do I not need a relief valve here? Not only not only why do I need it, and how big does it need to be? So.
Right, right. So when you say even if you don't have a relief device, if, for instance, you've got a atmospheric vent on a vessel, you still need the sizing calculations and information as if you had a relief device. But that
right.
open vent is your relief device, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you can go, I mean, honestly, you can go even further than that. If you, I don't know how you would do it with a tank necessarily, but, you know, if you have a piece of pressure equipment and you don't put a relief valve on there, you really need to explain why you don't need one.
Right, right. Because the ASME Section 8 would indicate you need to protect it from overpressure. So, mm-hmm. okay. And so when you get into scenario applicability, you said you need to document what applies and what doesn't apply, right?
Right, right.
Okay. So when you get into those and you've got something that does apply, then where do you go with that?
Yeah. So if you do have an applicable scenario, you would need to look at, I mean, it depends on the type of scenario. If we're talking about a blocked outlet or something like that, it's, I would say it's a good practice to document what is your maximum pressure. If for no other reason, the PHA would like to know that, and this can right. be a good reference for them too. The actual scenario, you do need to look at, okay, how big is that pump that's pointed to this equipment, or that compressor, or, you know, that control valve, what's that normal flow?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really, it's quantifying how much and what kind of flow, whether it's liquid, you know, gas, two phase, is it, you know, a big slug of liquid that has vapor behind it that's going to cause other issues too?
Right. So you need to really think through what does that scenario look like? How does it play out? And how much of what kind of fluid you're going to have to get out of the system to keep the pressure under control?
Right. Exactly.
Okay. And so from what I'm hearing, you need to have documentation for more things than just your external fire scenario, right?
Yeah, we've come a long way, I think. I guess I haven't been in the industry that long, but I've heard stories of, you know, relief calculations from the 50s where they size it for fire and then say, all right, that should catch everything else.
Right. It was more recent than that, even. I can remember early on in the 1990s, a lot of times that's all you sized for. And nobody gave much thought to anything else. But obviously, the expectations have come a long way since then, and that's one of those changes since the promulgation of the PSM standard. So what about small thermal RVs, these little 3/4 by 1 relief valves that are on just a long pipeline or interconnection between units and things like that? How do I calculate what my relief rate is for those?
Well, so I've seen it done both ways. API 521 is kind of the standard, the go-to standard, I'd say, for relief system design. It does say for thermal relief, if you have a 3/4 by 1 relief valve on there, that's good enough for that. You did mention long pipelines. That's probably the case where that guidance doesn't prove true. If you have a long enough pipeline, you know, miles and miles of large bore pipe, you could get enough solar heating from blocking that in that you will overwhelm your little, you know, 40, 50 gallon a minute, 3/4 by 1 relief valve.
Okay. And so those you may need to calculate, but otherwise those little ones, you can say, as long as I've got a relief valve of a nominal size, I'm good.
Yeah, that's fair to say.
Okay. Yep. Cause that's one thing that people kind of scratch their heads about, cause they're not even sure how to calculate that for thermal expansion, because it's such a small quantity that you're going to generate for most cases.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's, there, I guess there is some judgment there, and there are ways to do the calculations. I've seen some operators that, right, say you have a process cooler, right, with water on the opposite side. At some point, if that gets to be a big enough cooler, there's a real risk of heating up that water if you shut that flow off and isolate the exchanger while the process is still going. And so I have seen some cases there where, yeah, 3/4 by 1 doesn't cut it. We needed a 1 by 2 or even a little bit larger orifice 1 by 2 to make that work. So,
okay. Okay. So for our relief system design and design basis, we basically need to summarize all of the scenarios that could impact the equipment and whether it applies or doesn't apply. And then for everything that applies, What sort of material do we need to relieve to control the pressure? How much? What phase? So what other sorts of calculations do we need to confirm that the relief valve or relief device that we have is adequate?
Well, the first thing I would think of besides that would you need some sort of hydraulic analysis that shows that you're not going to build up too much back pressure and cause that relief valve to chatter. Same sort of thing on the inlet side. If you do reach a point where it's a very long run of small diameter pipe to get from your process to your relief valve, you'll have the same issue. Every time the relief valve opens, that pressure at the end of the line will drop and you'll reclose it and honestly, you won't get your relief capacity that you think you're going to get. Worst case, you actually damage your relief valve and have a bigger incident, right? So.
Right. Okay. So you need to calculate your hydraulics on the inlet and outlet piping. And then you also, I presume, need to calculate what the relief device itself can push out in terms of sizing.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. And that is, you've got, the MB18 Red Book. You can do that calculation. You really don't need some really advanced hydraulic solver to do it.
Right.
You can do all this by hand still.
Equations, yeah. Yeah. Although most people do prefer to use some technological help of some sort, whether it be an Excel spreadsheet or more fancy package. And so that MB18 for the discharge coefficients for each of the relief devices, those are unique to each brand and each model, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. They're all based on test data.
Okay. So a 4x6 of a Ferris isn't necessarily going to perform the same as a 4x6 from a Consolidated or something like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. It's a subtle difference, but you can get in trouble on, a very small sliver of applications switching between brands, and you find out that, oh, actually, that Ferris flows 1% less than that Consolidated, maybe I need to go up an orifice size or something like that.
Right. That's why some of our other podcasts where we've talked about management of change, changing a brand of a relief device really does require an MOC because there are some subtle differences among them, even though you're the same size. Mm-hmm. All right. So when we're talking about PHAs, what do we need to cross-check between the PHA scenarios and our relief documentation?
Well, I guess as far as what you would cross-check, I've seen it multiple times. You have a PHA that, either they go into an incident that happened or something, something they dream up and they say, oh, you know what, actually, if we're in this mode of operation and this happens, we could end up with a different relief scenario. So they can be a good check to identify scenarios that you wouldn't have thought of. They can also, it can also go the other way, too. I kind of alluded to that earlier, that when you're in a PHA, if you have that documentation that says, the maximum upstream pressure is limited by the, a pump deadhead pressure or where your centrifugal compressor stalls out. Mm-hmm. If you're looking at control valve failures, maybe your maximum normal operating pressure upstream, they can take that. Hopefully they verify it too, but they can take that and say, this is the pressure upstream and this is how we can risk rank that scenario, that if there were no relief valve, how high could this pressure really get? So.
Ah, okay. Good point. So they can use that relief documentation to help them pinpoint their scenario consequences.
Mm-hmm. Right. Perfect. Right. Definitely okay. Comes in handy for, I'm thinking like I'm in refining, right? But hydrotreating systems where you've got a high pressure, low pressure, interface between those two separators. And that's a good place to look for how well are we documenting.
So. Okay. Yeah. And the other thing that I've seen in audits is when you're looking at a PHA and you see a relief device called out as a safeguard, then you cross-check that with your process safety information to verify that you've got that documented as an applicable scenario and what the capacity is and that your relief valve is actually suitable for it. If it isn't, then you ought not be calling that as a safeguard in your PHA scenario.
Right. So, yeah, that is true. We could probably talk about that for hours, that whole nuance too, that, if you're doing a PHA and your relief valve is, it's not big enough, but it's, sort of big enough? You know, how much risk are you really carrying with that?
Right.
So I've seen that where, you know, they say it's not big enough and it's 1% too small, and their guidelines say, we got to pretend it's not there. I mean, kudos to them for getting that on a work list and making sure it happens. But, you know, how much risk are you buying down there? Not as much as you wrote down.
Right. Because it'll still perform. It just might not perform perfectly, but it'll be close. Okay.
You'll need a little extra overpressure than you're supposed to get. Right.
Okay. So let's look at the mechanical integrity side of things. So that's the other place in the standard that it calls out information. The relief devices and vent systems are among the categories of equipment that need to be included in your mechanical integrity program. So what sort of documentation should we have on that side when you come to inspections and tests?
Well, as far as what you need, I guess I'm not that familiar with all the 576 requirements, but, you know, it is a good practice to pop test your valves, make sure they're still performing at the end of their cycle, not just at the beginning. You definitely want to have internal inspection records for soft seated valves. I guess I used to work at a rubber company a long time ago. A good practice there would be to maybe save some samples of your material after a run to see, you know, if you want to say, here we had some degradation here, and
you're looking for any fouling or corrosion or other incompatibilities that might have come up during that runtime that might have hampered the valve.
That might be more of a useful for troubleshooting type of stuff. But I mean, yeah, what do you really need? You need to know, did the valve perform when I put it in, and did the valve perform when I took it out? And if it didn't, when I hit the end of that cycle, well, I probably shouldn't leave it in there as long if I'm not going to change anything, right?
Right. So if you're going on a 5-year cycle, for instance, and you pull it out and realize that it doesn't pop where it should have, it, you know, still stays seated for some reason, whether it's corroded or fouled or something like that, then maybe I need to back off on my inspection cycle to 3 years or 4 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. And when you say you need to make sure it's performing when you put it in, does that mean you need a pop test before you install it?
That would be a good idea. You would definitely want some certification for, yes, this valve did what it's supposed to do. Honestly, otherwise, you could just buy these things off eBay and slap them in and say, hey, you know, if it doesn't work, I'll leave the guy negative feedback. So
yeah, that sounds like a dangerous approach. So one other thing that I wanted to bring up is that, as you said, you know, unqualified people providing this equipment, if you're going to be rebuilding these, tearing them down, inspecting and reassembling them, then the personnel needs certain certifications, correct?
Yeah, there's a whole certification for the shop. I believe it's a VR certification that you get from the National Board or ASME. I forget exactly which one.
Right. I think it's an ASME board certification. So, yeah. Right.
I mean, they do come down and they'll watch you tear a valve apart and service it and make sure you're doing it right. I mean, following all the procedures you're supposed to. So.
Right. I think there's a lot more involved with the shop and the personnel and the training and their procedures and all of that sort of stuff to make sure that they do a quality job, because these are in many cases your last line of defense for preventing a catastrophic failure, and you certainly want them to work when they're needed. So we talked a little bit about wanting that pop test at the end. So even if I don't want to pay the money to service them and rebuild them or take the time to swap them out, and I just say, oh, I'm just going to buy a like-for-like replacement and put it in, is there still an advantage to doing a pop test of the old one that you pull out?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's where, if you have your own shop on site, that's great if you can do that. If not, yeah, it'll probably cost you a little bit more, but or at least you'll see that cost. But yeah, you do want that data of we did the pop test and, oh gosh, the seat's leaking terribly after 5 years. Or if you just swap the valve, you'd you'd never know, other right. than somebody telling you, hey, when we pulled it, we had a really hard time getting the pressure off of the outlet, which honestly, nobody's ever told me about how taking a valve out of service went. So
right. But I can imagine that you really do need that data in case you should be adjusting your interval for your inspections and replacements. That Absolutely. What's in the standard as a, I believe it's a 5-year cycle, you know, that's a starting point, and that shouldn't be set in stone necessarily unless you confirm it with your own test data.
I think they let you go up to 10 years, honestly, maybe the maximum. If you have right. if you have data to support, yes, this is, you know, the right metallurgy, the right soft goods, the right service. We're not too close to the set pressure. The whole list of things you can look at that can cause.
So that could be a cost savings where people are saying, oh, well, I'm just going to replace them like for like on a 5-year cycle. If they go through the effort of doing those tests, they may be able to extend that replacement cycle timeline, perhaps out to 10 years, if they get that test data and can support right. that choice. So that may be a cost savings potential for them.
Yep.
Okay.
And you know, that's the other thing too. If you do have a valve that you test and you find that you have an issue with it, you know, if you find out that, oh gosh, you know, we're just trying to use a regular nitrile rubber, maybe we should be looking at a Viton, or I guess I'm trying to think of not brand names, but, you know, we should be using an FKM, an FFKM, something like that instead to get that right. longevity out of the seal. And the same thing with the metallurgy. You can figure out how to engineer these valves so that they last up to 10 years and you don't have to spend all the time and energy, you know, taking them out, putting them back in on some right. shorter duration. So.
Right. Right. Okay. All right. So we covered a lot of information, both on the process safety information side, on what you need, the linkage with the PHA scenarios, and then the mechanical integrity. Is there anything else you can think of we want to mention to listeners about documentation requirements?
Yeah, I guess if there's something else, I mentioned it's kind of a rag gap basis. So these are always changing. I'm sure in, you know, 10, 20 years, what they expect will be a little different than what we're talking about right now.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I know a lot of people say, well, you know, I had this documentation on my relief devices from when they were put in back in, you know, 2000. Isn't that old project data still sufficient? So what you're saying is in the 22 years since then, the expectations have changed, so they may need to revisit that documentation, right?
Oh, absolutely. I've seen documentation and calculations from 22 years ago, and I can look at that and say, no, this isn't what we do now. we're missing a little bit of detail here and here. So.
Right. Yeah. And so it all hinges on that RAGA gap and what the expectations are. And with PSM, the expectations continue to ratchet up over the years. And mm-hmm. so if you haven't revisited your documentation for your relief devices in the last, say, 15, 20 years, it's probably something that you should take a closer look at before you get flagged on an audit for insufficient documentation on your relief device and design basis.
Right. No, yeah. If you can, honestly, it kind of like a PHA, how you run your PHA is that, right, they need to be revalidated every 5 years. It probably, I mean, it depends how much your process changes over the years too, but it wouldn't be a bad idea to have some sort of revalidation cycle for your relief system documentation, just kind of the same. So.
Right. Right. Ideally, any MOCs that you do would cycle back through with your updates to your relief calculations. But if you revalidate your documentation, that's a good opportunity to make sure that things didn't slip through the cracks from that MOC program. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that was a lot of valuable information for the listeners. Hopefully it gave everyone a lot to think about with regard to their relief documentation. If you have a comment about this week's episode, an idea for a future episode, or a question about anything process safety related, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us a voice message using the link in our episode description or shoot us an email at podcast@amplifyconsultants.com. And thanks, Chris, for your input today. Why don't you tell listeners how they can contact you if they have further questions?
Yeah, as far as if somebody likes to get in touch with me, I know I'm on LinkedIn. I guess I have a fair amount of communication between some people there. So you look me up on there for now.
Okay, I appreciate your time and help with this. For additional information on relief systems, you might want to listen to podcast episode 54 that covered some general design concepts, or episode 45 that included a lot of details regarding the piping design for relief devices. And finally, our goal at Amplify Process Safety is to partner with companies that handle highly hazardous chemicals to create world-class process safety systems, as it's our firm belief that these systems will help prevent catastrophic incidents like fires, explosions, and toxic releases. So please don't hesitate to reach out to us if we can help you on your process safety journey. Thank you for listening, and until next time, be safe out there.
We appreciate you joining us for this episode of Amplify Your Process Safety. Head to our website, amplifyconsultants.com, to find our show notes and other resources. Thank you for joining us in our mission to ultimately save lives by advancing process safety right here on Amplify Your Process Safety. Until next time.